You know you belong together, little big pod forever. You're talking on air. Nathan has weird hair. From the very first moment I heard you, I never felt such emotion. From talking on air, I said no, you are there. So hold me in your arms and let me go. I wanna stay forever, closer each day. Graham and Nate.
Yo, 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 what's going on? This is a very special episode, Graham.
Oh, I absolutely loved this episode. And the so it's weird. So we recorded it yesterday because we had to record it from our homes because the time we usually record at wasn't, didn't suit the guests we had on. But my God, am I happy we did it.
Yeah, well, first of all, fair play to you.
Play
you
to
have
me.
An office at home where you have a microphone, you have a desk, you are investing in audio, baby.
Oh, audio. Listen, I'm the audio guy around here, yeah?
I'm not. So I had to use my roommate Sean's room. He has top of the range stuff, so I felt guilty being in there. But you said to me last week, Drive to Survive.
Yes.
That is the Netflix docuseries that we're obsessed about, all about Formula One, behind the scenes footage. You get an insight into all the drivers and the backroom staff. And let's be honest, we were never interested in Formula One.
No, the last time I was interested in Formula One was when I had a PlayStation 1 and I used to drive Formula One on there.
Yeah.
And I'd be, Interlago, Brazil, go, 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 and it's lights out. But I kind of lost interest. I used to watch a little bit when I didn't have Sky back in the day. And all you would have, you watch it on Channel 4, I think it used to be on.
Mm.
But nothing major. Drive to Survive has changed everything.
Oh.
The amount of people, I say it in the interview with this guy, the amount of people that I watch it that have no interest in Formula 1,
yeah,
now love it. I was watching the first race in Bahrain.
Yeah.
So excited to watch it. Watch the whole thing, and I would never have done that before. Only now that I'm interested in the characters. Because usually you just know the likes of Lewis Hamilton, Michael Schumacher, the guys that are winning. But the excitement is in the midfield with these guys who don't know if they want to have a job next year.
Yeah.
Or if they're trying to take somebody else's seat.
Yeah, there's a lot of highs and lows. And there's been three seasons. You listening right now, if you haven't watched it before,
if you're looking for something to watch,
I really recommend it because once you're in, you're in.
Yeah.
It's so addictive. But in the most recent season, season 3, episode 6, there's a cameo appearance from an Irish man with a big red beard.
Yeah.
And you said to me, can we try and get this guy on the podcast?
Mm.
And I thought, God, it would be amazing. So I just slid into his DMs on Instagram.
This guy, I know we're throwing compliments out. Tracked him down in less than 20 minutes.
And I just DM'd him and I said, would you like to be on a podcast? I never give the stats or figures.
No.
They don't need to know that.
No, that's...
We know that we're wasting their time.
Absolutely.
But they don't know that. And he said, absolutely. His name is Patrick Harding.
So didn't actually really know what he did.
He was
hanging around a lot with one of the main drivers on one of the main teams, Alex Albon. And he was there chatting to him a good bit. And he seemed to be around him every time you saw Alex, because it was an episode dedicated to him.
Yeah.
Like, who is this guy? What's this guy's deal?
And the team is Red Bull, okay? They are like the second most popular team.
You're talking... Liverpool.
Yeah.
If Man City had the number one team in England, well, if Plant anymore, but you're talking like a big team.
But this man is called Patrick Harding. He is a performance coach. He looks after Alex physically and mentally. He's like his sort of au pair in a way. He just makes sure that Alex is focused for his next race. And Alex has a stressful time. There's no denying he joins the Red Bull team halfway through the season because he replaces...
That was in season two.
Season two.
That was the year before.
He replaces someone else.
Pierre Gasly.
A very sexy Frenchman.
Pierre Gasly.
Look, Patrick was really up for doing this interview. He has such a big CV. And we were worried, Graham, we only had 40 minutes with him.
We decided only have 40 minutes.
Yeah.
We could buy a Zoom account that extends the 40 minutes.
We don't have the budget, baby.
But how we made it feel okay in our heads, we go, well, we don't want to take up too much of his time.
Yeah.
We also don't want to pay the $13.99 a month for the occasional Zoom call that we do. And also we were thinking, Aren't podcasts better when you keep them tight?
So Graham and I were chatting to Patrick, which you will hear, and he's full of beans. Like, he gives long answers. But I had agreed with you that I was going to have the WhatsApp account open.
Oh, I know.
On the laptop.
I know you didn't.
Completely forgot.
Yeah.
So halfway through the interview, Graham messages me on WhatsApp, but I look at my phone.
Yeah.
And also with my phone, to click in, it's the whole facial recognition. So I'm looking down at my phone and it's not opening.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I only said, keep WhatsApp open on your desktop so that keep it side by side with the Zoom.
Yeah.
So if I need to contact you or say something to you, because we've never done this podcast, not with each other. So we can always do hand signals or pass each other notes if we don't want to seem rude.
I do miss the hand signals.
I said, keep it on WhatsApp so it's on the screen. So you're still looking at the screen.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look like you're rude looking at your phone. What do I see 9 minutes to go?
I looked rude.
Looking down at his phone.
I looked rude twice because you sent me two messages. But the time absolutely flew by.
Such a good one.
40 minutes. I will say, Patrick, I don't know if he's going to listen to himself back. He's probably not narcissistic like you and I.
If you do, shout out. Thanks for checking
Thanks
it
so
out.
Much. Patrick did say after the interview, because it goes by so quickly.
So quickly.
And we had so many more questions.
Yeah.
He said, guys, message me again. I'd love to come on.
I think we will, because you'll hear at the end, he's going to the Olympics.
Mm.
So he's an incredible guy, incredible CV. He's an Irish man living in London, but traveling the world, doing what he loves doing and meeting incredible people. So here's our chat with the performance coach of the Formula One driver, Alex Albon, Patrick Harding.
Hey, bro.
We're recording. Turn on that camera.
Can you see me?
Nope, not yet.
Oh, here we go, baby.
Not yet. Look at this. Two.
Look at me.
Professionals.
how do I sound in front of this microphone?
I better turn mine up. I think I'm a little bit low. 1, 2, 3. Who's Gemma?
Do we have a Gemma logging on?
Gemma has asked to be admitted. I'm going to invite
Gemma in.
We'll go with it. Nathan and I are recording this remotely from our bedrooms. It's a little bit later, and we're going to give this a go. I am recording. We are ready to go. Let's find out who Gemma is. Here we go.
It's not Gemma, lads, I promise.
We were wondering who Gemma was, Patrick.
That's my alternate ego, lads.
I'm so disappointed now. I thought we had a Gemma on.
Wait till the camera comes on.
There he
is. There he goes.
Patrick, awesome. Patrick. Welcome to Graham and Nathan's Little Big Podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
I would, of course. Thanks for having me, lads. My name is Patrick Harding, and I'm a performance coach in professional sport.
I have to say, Patrick, Graham and I, we are so excited to chat to you. You have your video on. You're having a good mug of Joe. Hopefully it's not alcohol. But I have to say, Patrick, we will be transparent. Graham and I, we weren't really into Formula One until we watched the Netflix series Drive to Survive. We're absolutely obsessed. But then in the most recent season, episode 6, we see a very sexy, ginger bearded man make a cameo appearance. Patrick, how the hell did you get involved in the Formula One?
Well, firstly, I can't say I'm or was a Formula One fan myself, but I certainly have an appreciation for the sport now, that's for sure. How did I get involved? I mean, how long do you want the answer to be? But basically, always been involved in professional sports, qualified as a physiotherapist, and then did my master's in strength and conditioning, and recently qualified as a mental performance coach as well. Normally based in squad-based sports, but then started to transition to individual athletes because I just really enjoyed the detail that you could get into with individuals, and started working with a couple of Irish guys, actually, Michael Conlon, boxer, and Paul Dunn, the golfer. And then just really randomly, as most things these days, just got a tweet one day from one of my lecturers from the MSc in strength and conditioning, just replying to another guy going, have a chat with this lad. And it was basically this guy looking for somebody with physio qualifications in elite sport, but with SSC qualifications as well. So ended up having a conversation with this guy, did 4 rounds of interviews, still didn't really know what the company were or what they did. And then at the last interview, they just said, look, the confidentiality clauses, we have a lot of Formula One drivers and Formula Two drivers, and they're who we supply performance coaches to. And yeah, we'd be happy if we could place you at one of those drivers. And that's kind of it, really. It was just a, you know, I've always approached my career like that, a little bit of focus on what you're doing right now and do a really good job, and the opportunities will look after themselves. And when they do come up, explore it and see if it fits for you. And that's kind of how it came about. And actually, they offered me a Formula One role initially, and I turned it down because I would have had to give up working with Michael and Paul, and I'd already committed to them for the season. So we did a year in Formula Two with a Japanese driver called Tadasuka Makino, who was part of the Honda project. Really great guy. Yeah, just really enjoyed the role and got to know Alex that year because he was in Formula Two. He was fighting out for the championship with Lando and George that year, Lando Norris and George Russell. And then he got the call to go to Toro Rosso the next year. My Japanese driver went back to Japan to race in Super Formula. We got together and yeah, we thought our philosophies fitted with each other, and I've been with Alex for the last 3 years. It wasn't a conscious thought process of a career path. Okay, I want to get into Formula One. And like I said, it was an opportunity that came up and one that was a little bit too good to turn down.
So Patrick, Nathan and I, as you said, we're being transparent. We didn't really know much about Formula One before Drive to Survive. So
I still don't.
I'm going to try and kind of explain, because I'm conscious as well that people are listening mightn't understand Formula One. So I'm going to try and describe and explain things as we go along, but it's purely based off Drive to Survive. So if I see anything incorrect, feel free to correct me.
Which is,
all right?
And a caveat for me as well is Drive to Survive is the EastEnders of Formula One or the Coronation Street. So there is a significant amount of dramatization involved.
You kind of remind me, Patrick, of Big Mo.
Funny, that's the look I was going for. Either that or Ian Beale.
Right, okay, so you are...
If you said Pat Butcher, I was hanging up.
You are the performance coach of Alex Albon. So he... Yes. Was racing with Red Bull Racing, which yes. were the number two in the Drivers Constructors last year. But you joined yes. up with Alex when he was in Toro Rosso. So they're kind of a yeah. midfield team who are the feeder system to Red Bull Absolutely. Racing. What was it like? Because I remember watching it, I think was it in season two when Alex moved from Toro Rosso in the middle of the season yeah. to Red Bull? What was Red the Bull. Change like for you two guys? Did you change anything for when he moved team, or did you just keep the same focus? Because I presume for Alex the pressure was a lot bigger because it was a bigger team and more was expected of him.
Absolute change, nothing. There was no reason to change anything. The process that we had in place had gotten him the call to Red Bull. So why would you suddenly start throwing out what you'd done that was successful just to replace it because you'd moved teams? And actually we had that very specific conversation, and we said the only thing we were going to change was our kit. You know, we still approached the race weekends in the same way. Our training schedule was still the same. Our travel schedules were still the same. Everything that we had applied at Toro Rosso, we were going to template it across a Red Bull. Obviously, there was a huge change in scrutiny, media attention, expectation. But that's something very different. That was more along the lines of Alex staying true to his philosophy of how he wanted to race and how he wanted to drive. And understanding that there was going to be a period of time where he just needed to give himself a break to get to grips with the technical demands of the car. I'm sure you will have picked up from Drive to Survive, or even if you followed any of the F1 stuff from last year, you know, the RB car from last year was a tricky car to drive. And he had a very strong finish to that season when he went from Toro Rosso to Red Bull. And then, you know, last year, again, that expectation jumps up again. But, you know, very much with Alex, it doesn't really matter to him what's said in the media, because he is his own harshest critic. So when he, you know, he gets asked, oh, do you read anything in the media? He says no, and it's not him being flippant or being rude. He's very much of the opinion, there's nothing that they can say that I wouldn't have already said to myself. And that's partly why he's so successful, and it's partly why he's so driven to be successful, is that expectation he puts on himself. And when you move to Toro Rosso, I guess for me as a performance coach, what we needed to try and keep a hold of was his own expectations of himself in that car, and the understanding that you do need to have some time to get yourself up to speed with the new setup, the new team, the new engineers, and come to grips with the new media attention. So yeah, to go back to your original question, very, very keen that we kept everything as, I guess, familiar as possible, so that the transition to the new team felt as seamless as possible. But like I also said, why you change something that's worked for you to date, you know?
Now, I noticed with these drivers, there's not a pick of fat on them. They're so petite. I look at Lando Norris, Pierre Gasly, even Alex. What is the training? Because they do a lot of working out. And I was also very surprised by the amount of exercises they do with their neck.
So they have a weight restriction. So it's a weight restricted sport. So in your kit, getting into the car, you can't be any more than 80 kilos. If you're more than 80 kilos, then you get penalized. So the drivers naturally have to be at a certain weight. So their kit is about 4.5 kilos in weight, maybe a little bit more. I guess if you start to delve down into the physical demands of the actual sport itself. So you've got races that last anything up to 2 hours, and you've got 5 sessions across a race weekend. The two on Friday are 90 minutes each. So there's a huge component of aerobic capacity that these drivers need just to be able to be active for those extended periods of time across a race weekend. But then within those sessions and within races, there's periods where their heart rate will actually be, you know, with Alex, anything 170 plus for 5, 10, 15 minutes. If he's in qualifying, if the adrenaline is going, if he's in a race and he's defending a position, or if he's trying to overtake, there's huge spikes in his heart rate that stay at high levels for an extended period of time. So he has to do a lot of anaerobic threshold training just to be able to maintain his heart rate at high levels. But it's not just being able to keep your heart rate there. At those zones, he still needs to react really quickly. He still needs to be able to react quickly, but with precision. He still needs to make good decisions about strategy and about how he overtakes, how he defends. And they have very specific time windows for each lap. So if you talk, 57 lap race, there won't be very little variation in his lap time across those 57 laps. So the level of consistency that they need to deliver is incredible. So there's a big element of cognitive capacity along with the physical fitness. So when we train under heavy conditions, we do a lot of cognitive training while we do that, so that he can practice, I guess, his memory recall and his processing at high speeds and under fatigue. But as you mentioned with the neck, look, the biggest thing is obviously the G-force, and G-force is your gravity with change of direction. And if you take the average head and helmet, I mean, Alex has a bigger head than most people. I mean, physically, not ego-wise. It's about 7.5-8 kilos. So if you take, there's a sequence of corners in Silverstone called Maggots and Becketts, but there's actually 4 corners, and it's a 5G, a 4G, a 3G, and a 5G corner. Now, one sequence of change of direction through there is about 140 kilos through his neck, just one sequence. Now, the race at Silverstone, I think, is a 56 lap race, but also they've done three practice sessions and a qualifying session before that. So they could do anything up to 150 laps in a race weekend through that one sequence. So it's not just his capacity to withstand big G forces, so big loads. It's the repetition of those loads over a period of time. So, yeah, we do a lot of max strength training on his neck. So his 1RM, so side flexion on his neck, is 60 kilos plus. And his extension is about 55, 60 kilos as well. And then we train around, we do the majority of our training between 15 and 35 kilos. That's more repetitions. That's more isometric stuff over time. So his neck is incredibly conditioned. You know, he can do a full body plank. So if he puts a plyo box on one side, plyo box on the other side, ankles on one box, and he can just rest the side of his head on the box on the other end.
What?
And he's a straight plank. And then we'll add weight to that. So he'll hold a 5 kilo, 10 kilo disc with that.
So instead of planking with your arms, he's planking with his neck.
Yeah. So the side of his head will be on the box and his feet will be on the other box, and he'll be a straight plank. And then he'll weight that.
So obviously these drivers, you see the clips throughout the series, they're coming up from karting as young kids, and then they're moving into the different levels. How young will they have to start these days to make it working out as intensive as this?
Look, the majority of them do start really young. You know, Alex started karting at 7 and 8, and the majority of them start like 7, 8, 9 in karting championships, regional, and then they move on to Europe if they're good enough. There's one driver in Formula 2, actually, he's a Red Bull Academy driver called Yuri Vips, and he started in single-seaters, which is really, really unusual. A lot of them get talent spotted through karting, but yeah, like I said, they'll generally have started their karting career by 7, 8, or 9, and then they'll progress through, like I said, local championships, regional championships, and then on to Europe. So actually, Alex, in his final year of karting, was in the same category as Max, and they competed against each other for the World Championships and the European Championships. Nice. So like a lot of these guys, they know each other, especially that younger generation. There's about 8 or 9 drivers there that all kind of competed around the same time with each other in karting.
So you touched on, Patrick, the pressure to be a Red Bull driver. You really have to withstand all this pressure. And Alex was struggling at a stage. What would you say to Alex the morning of a race to make sure he was mentally focused?
Yeah, I guess I'm going to challenge that question a little bit in terms of there was an external perception that he was struggling with the pressure. But it wasn't him struggling with the pressure that the environment was putting on him. He was going introvert because he was trying. I guess he was just frustrated that he wasn't going quick enough. So he was actually just being really harsh on himself. There was nothing, like I said, there was nothing that anyone could say in the media or anybody in the team could say to him that in any way affected his performance. For him, it was always, you know, looking inside, how do I make this situation better? How do I get to grips with the car? So I think what you saw there was an individual who had a finite amount of energy choosing to use that energy in a positive way, which was, right, how do I make this car go quicker? And, you know, from a consistency point of view, you know, we got these young drivers. Look, you take Alex, Lando and George, three of them are fighting out for the F2 championship together. Three of them came into F1 together. You know, George has had 2 years at Williams and Lando has had 2 years at McLaren. And if you take the three of those young guys last year, what you very often get with young elite athletes is they've got the technical ability, but they don't have the consistency. And that consistency comes with time. That comes with learning, that comes with experience, that comes with the right supervision, exposure, all of those emotional learning that they get. You know, if you look at all of those three guys across last year, they were probably at the same level of consistency. I think the difference was George was at Williams, there was no expectation. So you have a good race and it's brilliant. You have a bad race and it's the car's fault. You know, Lando was at a car in the, you know, upper midfield, which were starting to get really competitive at the end of the season. So, you know, you have a bad qualifying and you know, you're 10th, 11th, 12th. Nobody really bats an eyelid, but then you have a good qualifying and you're 5th or 6th. Suddenly that's a great day. But actually for Alex, it was like, okay, you've got to be top 4, top 5. And if you're 8th or 9th in qualifying, suddenly it's a disaster. So I guess his inconsistency, but more the perception of what he was doing on a week-to-week basis. So yeah, from that point of view, I thought he handled it incredibly well. And actually his last 4 races of the season were probably his strongest, you know, and that's a guy demonstrating an incredible level of self-assurance and mental resilience. But to go back to your original question, I mean, it's not like we're standing in the driver's room and I'm quoting Any Given Sunday to him walking around like Al Pacino.
You know, inch by inch.
Yeah, inch by inch, you know. It would get tired after a while. But, you know, we know each other so well. I can tell by how he says hello to me in the morning time what kind of mood he's in. Very often it was just understanding where he was in his state of mind and trying to alter that state of mind through the environment. So I mean, a perfect example of it is on the grid before a race, he can go really introvert again. So he'll go inside himself, and I know he's just going through procedure after procedure after procedure. So start procedure, first lap, second lap. But at that point, we've already done all of that stuff and it's not the time to think about that. Then you're just overthinking. So I can recognize that. And what my job then to do is to change that mind state. So talk about something stupid. I mean, you know, when we went to Red Bull first and on the grid, a couple of times his engineer were coming over, me and Alex were just having the most random conversations on the grid, to the point where the engineer came up to me after the second race. He was like, what are you guys talking about? Like, it's just, and I said, well, and I explained that what we were doing, and he was like, okay, that makes sense. So it's more about Alex, you know, Alex doesn't need me to motivate him, but what my job is to understand his mental state, where he's at, and maybe direct him to either a more positive state or take him from a more negative state to somewhere that is a little bit more productive. I guess our mantra for the whole season and for the last 3 years was leave no stone unturned and leave nothing on the table. So get to the end of the season and be happy with what you've delivered, and just make sure that you can look yourself in the mirror and know that there wasn't anything else you could have done. We did always like to have a little fist pump in the car when he got in just before the race or just before quali. So I'd just lean in, stick my fist in, and he'd just give me a little tap, and that was our little thing.
Yeah. I would be interested to talk about last year's Bahrain Grand Prix, where Romain Grosjean had that horrendous crash. And if you aren't aware, the car split in two and went into the barrier and it went on fire. And thankfully, he walked out alive with burns on his hands. It was incredible. But all the drivers, that was on the first or second lap, and the drivers had to go back.
First lap.
Drivers had to go back. They had to get out of the car, wait for the car to be removed, wait for Romain Grosjean to find out if he's okay. And then they went back on the track. And correct me if I'm wrong, didn't Alex come third in that race?
He got a podium in that race. So actually, they had to wait to fix the barrier. It was about a 45, 50 minute delay.
Two questions. What was going on around that time? Obviously, I'm sure there was a lot of concern around the pit lane at that time. And secondly, how do you get a driver in the mindset to go back in a car? Now, I'm sure those guys, they understand the dangers that they're undertaking. Was there a conversation between both of you? And then obviously he was in the perfect mindset to get P3 then at the end of the race.
I guess you don't get the Formula One without having a shunt or two. And, you know, Alex has had a couple of big shunts over the last couple of years. So they have all experienced crashes in their career. So it's not necessarily the crash that they fear. Alex, when we were talking about it afterwards, he was ahead of the crash and he'd come around turn four. So in Bahrain, then turn four goes down. And he said he looked back up and he could just see a big ball of fire. And he came straight on the radio and he just said, is Roman okay? Or is the driver okay? He didn't say Roman because obviously he didn't know who it was, but he just said something like, is the driver okay? And his engineer just goes, we're just waiting to see. So by the time he'd gotten back around to the pit box, Roman had actually gotten out of the car and the engineer had come on, he's all good, he's walked away. Then he's fine. His immediate concern is the driver okay? Once the driver has gotten out of the car, he's back in. Then it's just a crash. What you don't necessarily want him to do is stand in the garage just watching it on replay over and over again. So you bring him back to the driver's room, you get him nice and settled, you make sure he's okay, get him some nutrition, get him some hydration stuff. And then as we get a timing for when they're getting back into the car, then you just start the warm-up ramp-up procedure again. So it's nearly like a new race again. You've kind of put that to one side. But like I said, once the drivers know that the driver in the crash is safe, then they're pretty relaxed about it. I mean, it was absolutely horrific. I'm really close with Roman's trainer and I know Roman really well. So we'd gone to see him in the hospital afterwards and just him describing the crash was pretty frightening actually. And to be able to get out with just some burns on his hands was pretty incredible and a testament to the safety of these cars. You know, that a lot of drivers had a moan about the halo being introduced a few years ago, but I've been with a couple of drivers now that the halo has really significantly improved their health through crashes, you know. And that was just testament to the halo, you know, for the barrier to have split and the halo to run up. The barrier to run up the halo just saved his life.
Have you ever had a go driving one of the cars?
Alex wouldn't let me drive his own car, never mind the Formula One. We went karting in Bahrain, the team and the mechanics and some of the hospitality people. And I was absolutely dead last. To the point where I was in a race on my own at the back and Helmut Marko was there watching. And like every time I drove through the start finish line, I could just see him laughing at me. And to make it worse, Alex had given me one of his helmets to wear. So it was really obvious it was me. So I'm sitting there in like Formula One helmet in a kart about 25 seconds behind the second to last person. And I got out of the car and helmet was just fleecing me for the next 6 hours. So no, to answer your question, there's absolutely no chance. I don't think I'd even be able to get out of the garage. I reckon I'd just drive it into the pit wall straight across.
These cars
are worth so much money.
You were talking about how it's all dramatised on Netflix, and obviously it is, and it's a bloody great drama because the amount of people I was talking to that had no interest in Formula 1 but they're interested in it now. How intrusive are the cameras? Because you were, I think it was episode 6 you were on, you got a few lines out there. Were you looking forward to getting on the telly? And how does it actually work, the making of it all?
What actually goes out, they record a huge amount, so they will be with you for an entire race weekend, to the point where actually, and obviously they're very good at what they do, it's very much a fly on the wall. So they're kind of floating around in the background. You're mic'd up and you know you're mic'd up. So the guys are pretty good. If you're having a private conversation with somebody, you can just say to them, look, that's not available for edit. So they're really good. Intrusive, they're not intrusive in terms of trying to contrive things, but they are always around. So if you're going to have a private conversation, you can just ask them to leave the room. So once they don't have audio and video together, they can't use it. So if you've asked them to leave the room, even if they're listening on the mic, they can't use it in the edit. So yeah, they are around, and it's not always something that the drivers want, but they appreciate, like exactly like you said, you know, they've got so many people interested in Formula One that wouldn't have been interested in it before. So the drivers are naturally going to benefit from that through, you know, viewership and notoriety and stuff that, you know, from brands that they support. Yeah, so they kind of have to accept that. You know, there's benefits to having them around. I don't think the drivers have much of a choice because the team signed the contract. So,
yeah, the Red Bull team principal is a man called Christian Horner. He'd be essentially your boss. And you said in a recent interview, you have a great memory of having a barbecue in his house. Can you expand on that? Because that sounded cool.
Yeah, so in normal times, and I hate using that phrase, but in normal times at the Silverstone race weekend, Christian will have a barbecue at his house for the Red Bull drivers, their trainers, and then Helmut Marko and a few other, you know, Adrian Newey, the chief designer, some people like that were there, and the Honda head guys. So we were there 2 years ago, and a couple of guys playing acoustic stuff in the corner and just had a barbecue. And then in very Irish fashion, actually, it was, okay, who's going to sing first? And there was just this really surreal moment of one of the Japanese Honda guys, Yosuke, singing Don't Look Back in Anger in like the heaviest Japanese accent that you can think of. And you had Jerry Halliwell and Mel B like in front, just screaming and singing the chorus with him. And it's just one of those moments where you're just like, am I high or how has this come about? Like, it's just some really surreal moments like that. But Christian's a nice guy. You know, Red Bull's a little bit unusual in that they have Christian Horner and then they have Helmut Marko. And Helmut Marko was called a special advisor to Red Bull, but it's nearly like a shared team principal role. And you've got Christian, who's probably more good cop, and then Helmut, who's a little bit more bad cop. So, yeah, you know, Christian was a driver himself. He raced at a relatively high level supercars. So he gets it from a driver point of view, but he's also an engineer. So he gets it from a technical perspective. And that's kind of what you want, managing drivers, because there's those two really key elements in them performing well.
And just for people who don't know, Christian Horner is married to Jerry Halliwell. That's half the Spice choice. Girls weren't just at this random party.
Just happened. They came with me, actually. They're
friends. Talking about team principals, Toto Wolff, the team principal of Mercedes, said in the last episode, just the toll it takes traveling around the world, because you're gone for the guts of the year, traveling to places like Bahrain, Australia, you've got Azerbaijan, all over the place. You've been in it, what, 3 or 4 years now. How have you adapted to it, and do you see yourself doing it for much longer? Because it must take a toll, especially on your personal life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess from a personal life perspective, you know, I've been involved in elite sport for about 12 years now. And to get here, you have to make a lot of sacrifices. So I've missed countless weddings and, you know, christenings and birthdays. And, you know, I've been living in London for nearly 13 years now. So you're kind of used to making that level of sacrifice because you've always kind of done that. I guess physical toll perspective, yeah. I mean, look, there's a huge amount of science out there around the management of jet lag. And, you know, we've developed jet lag strategies for Alex, and I just use the same strategies. So you know, the key things that you want to do to minimize the effects of jet lag, we incorporate them into all of our travel schedules and sleep patterning and melatonin and light exposure and food, etc. So we use all of that. So everything that we do from a science point of view is probably as evidence-based as you can get it. But that doesn't mean that there's times where you're just absolutely shattered, especially, I mean, we say last year was easy in terms of, you know, I'd say 14 out of 17 races were in Europe, and Europe is just so easy. You know, you're out on Friday, you're back Sunday night. It's a 1-3 hour flight maximum. There's no jet lag. It's easy. It's like going to work. It's the year before when we were doing what we call the flyaways, which are the longer races. So I remember that first year getting to Suzuka, and I'm not really sure where we'd been before. We'd been Singapore, Russia, and then we were going on to the Americas. So we were going from Suzuka over to, I think, Brazil and Mexico and Austin. And I remember just getting to the hotel room in Suzuka and just being absolutely shattered. And it was like 6 o'clock in the evening. My body clock was all over the place. And I guess over the years, you just learn what works for you. So for me, what really helps to stabilize my body clock is exercise and food. So making sure I get exercise in every day, making sure I'm eating on the time I want to be for that country that I'm in. And then, yeah, obviously sleep is so important, and getting your sleep patterns on as quickly as you possibly can. And then when you get back home, it's making sure that you do have a day or a day and a half to decompress and to just, you know, they're physically demanding, but they're emotionally demanding as well. You know, they're intense weekends. You know, you've got guys competing at the top of their game, and it's a high fuel, high adrenaline environment. So you just need 24 hours. And I'm actually quite an introvert in terms of, you know, I get my energy from being on my own or just being around minimal amounts of people. And, you know, I live in London, but there's parks close by, and we've got a little dog here, and I'm a morning person, so I get up around 6 a.m, take him out for half an hour, 45 minute walk, and that is enough for me just to reset and get my head straight and get ready for the day. So putting science in place, so understanding the demands of jet lag and what you can do to minimize it, but also then understanding yourself and what you need to try and be able to separate yourself out from that environment and get the time that you need to get your own headspace and batteries rejuvenated as well.
Patrick, we have to ask you, you also were a physio at Arsenal, and Graham and I are massive football fans.
Okay.
Very quickly, I want to ask you a few like quick round questions, okay?
Go for it.
So who was the Arsenal manager when you were working there?
Arsene Wenger. It was his last two seasons, yeah.
Oh, who is the most injury-prone footballer at Arsenal that season?
It's a difficult, yeah. Look, some of them were unlucky. Danny Welbeck had a few injuries. Theo Walcott had a few injuries, yeah. There's a few guys that were unlucky and had just a bad run, yeah.
Was there any footballer that played when they probably shouldn't have? They were quite injured, but they got the injection.
Yeah, look, that wasn't something that we went down the line of in terms of giving players injections just to play. You know, these guys, they're prize athletes, prize commodities for the club. So you're always thinking about the long term. You know, certainly there was players, you're kind of a bit on the edge of, do they need another game out or can they play this game? And you do a fitness test and you're still a bit like, okay, like technically they passed the fitness test, but maybe they should have sat that one out. And they either get through the game or they don't. But, you know, that's very much a decision that you make at the time. So I wouldn't say, you know, again, you know, you're not whacking injections on just to get people out on the pitch, but it's a well considered decision process, and yeah, it's risk versus reward. That's what it always comes down to.
Are you a football fan, and do you support Arsenal? And
no.
Who do you support, and how did you find it with your allegiances?
Huge football fan, like massive. From a kid, like I would watch the Super Sunday game on a Sunday, and then I'd watch it replayed on the Monday. Like that's, I mean, it was crazy football fan. But a little bit of a curveball, I'm a Nottingham Forest fan.
And No way.
Yeah. Proper old school, yeah. I had an uncle who was just so old school, and he was obsessed with Brian Clough.
Yeah.
So my brothers were United fans, and my friends were all either Leeds or Chelsea or Liverpool, like the majority of my generation in Ireland. And I was just like, I just don't want to support anyone that everyone else is supporting. And the more I heard about Forest, like they were actually good at that time. And my dad took me to see Forest against Shelburne Rovers in Talca Park in a pre-season friendly, and it was Teddy Sheringham's debut for Forest, and he scored in the 1-1 nil, and that was me sold for life. Forest fan ever since. To the good and bad.
That's amazing. From all the sacrifices that you've made, has it been worth it?
Absolutely. If it wasn't, I wouldn't still be doing it. Yeah.
What is the plan now going forward? What do you have planned for the future?
I guess the next 12 months in the immediate future, I'm still working with Alex. He's a reserve driver this year, and he'll have some testing days. He's going to drive some DTM races. You know, he's very much available if opportunities come up in F1 and the team needs a seat filled. I'm working with a Formula 3 driver this year as well, who's with Prema, a young kid, really good kid, Ollie Caldwell. So I'll be at 7 races with him this year. I'm going to the Olympics with a British Team GB athlete. And then I've Michael Condon still working with, you know, great guy. I've been with him since he turned professional. He's got a big fight at the end of this month against Baluta, and then he beats Baluta, he goes on hopefully for WBO world title shot against Stephen Fulton from America. So big year for him. It's kind of, you know, he's he's had a few years of development and he's changed trainer and he's in a really good place now physically and mentally, and I think he's ready to step up and take a world title. So a big 12 months coming up, if, and I hope it does come through, but if Alex gets back into F1, then 2022, I feel like, you know, if things are still good and the relationship's good, then could give it another whirl for a year, see what happens. Further on down the lane, I've always wanted to have my own performance center, somewhere where the athletes can come and train, stay and train, do training camps, but also, you know, have some physiotherapy intervention, have some nutritional support, some SNC delivery, and have it for elite to semi-elite athletes, both locally and athletes internationally. So that's definitely the dream for the future, and I think that's getting closer and closer, if I'm honest. And, you know, I've been away from Ireland for 14 years now, so I would say if we can, then that would be done in Ireland, and it's time to get a little bit closer to home, to family and friends. You know, I think probably that's one of the biggest learnings from COVID was, you know, you can still be really close to family and still be really far away at the same time. So it would be nice just to get a little bit closer to home. And our family are huge into GA, and I played GA all my younger life and into my early 20s, and I'd love to get back involved with GA, either in coaching or science provision. So yeah, that's probably the long-term goal.
Nice.
Oh, it's always going to involve sport in some capacity.
Jesus, we're just so in awe of your life.
But it's like one of those things where it's your career, so you don't have that perspective on it.
Yeah,
and of course.
You know, I've always known that I've had some really incredible experiences, but I've also known that I've worked my arse off to get myself here. So it's not, and also, you know, you would not survive in this environment if you were a bit of a fanboy. So you kind of have to keep a little bit of objectivity to it, you know? So,
yeah, that's why, you know, Graham and I would not last.
As you can tell by this.
Lewis Hamilton signed my ass.
No, it'd be all about Gunther for me. From Haas.
Gunther!
What a legend. Yeah, absolutely.
Patrick, thank you so much for joining us. You've given us so many nuggets of gold, and we were so excited to talk to you today. Yeah. You're absolutely killing it. As an Irish man living abroad and travelling the world, I'm sure people are looking on fondly and delighted for your success. But Patrick, thank you so much for joining us on Graham and Aidan's Little Big Podcast. Cheers, and best luck with everything in the future.
Yeah, go on. Listen, catch up with me again sometime if you want.
Oh, definitely, 100%. Patrick, thanks so much, man. Bye. Take care, brother.
Have a good day, boys.
Cut my life into pieces. This is my last resort. Suffocation.